Good morning. Well, I find this to be a very odd day, since it's Be Kind to Spiders Day. And I just find that a little bit odd. I will admit, I am not too kind to spiders. I don't know how many of you are kind or not to spiders, but this is the day that really challenges your gut reflex actions in that area. Anyway, so happy Be Kind to Spiders Day. Other things going on. So, no more class assignments, right? Yay. Don't forget to get your last lab assignment in, if you haven't already turned that in. Make sure that you get that in. I posted a few days ago, and I keep forgetting to tell you about this, a listing of all the scores that I have for each of you, not including the last assignments. I'm going to try to get a new sheet out there, but there's one posted out there that has everything up, the first five assignments and so forth. So I would like for you, when you get a chance, to stop by. It's where I, it's in the same box where I post the scores on the exams. I'd like for you to take a look at that and make sure that I've actually got all the assignments that you've turned in. If there's an assignment that's missing, please come by my office and we'll go searching for it and see if we can find it. So check that out, and I will update that fairly soon when I can get a chance to print out the new list and so forth. So check that. And of course, the final exam is coming a week from today. Same time, same place. Cumulative, on and on, the things that I've been telling you about will all come true on that day. So make sure that you take a close look back at the last three lab exercises. Just keep that stuff in mind, although we are kind of talking about a lot of that stuff anyway in lecture. Question answers Tuesday. People ask me, I meant to clarify this at lecture last 2 days ago, that's Tuesday and Wednesday of next week, not this week, right? So if you think you missed the question answer, you didn't. It's next week at 12:30 on Tuesday and 3 o'clock on Wednesday in our lab room, right? Not the other room, in our lab room, so that we can meet there one last time and have a little more fun. And don't forget, study hard, because if you do 10% better on the final than your two midterms, I will double that final exam score and eliminate those two midterm scores. So maybe give a few of you a little boost there to help your grade a little bit. So all sorts of excitement coming in the near future. Also, don't forget to go in and evaluate all your classes. I've already been talking with some students. We're trying to do some registration stuff, and we're bumping up against these holes and stuff. So if you haven't already evaluated all your classes and you still have registration stuff to do, you've got to go in and do that all those evaluations before you can do any more registration activity. I'd also encourage you, at least when you're evaluating this class, there are places, I believe, to make written comments, and I'd really encourage you to make written comments, things that you would like to tell me, good, bad, in between, whatever, because those usually are the most telling. Those are the where we get the best information from students. It's from the written comments rather than the canned questions that help us, but they're not necessarily the questions I would have asked. Also, don't forget to, when you're doing your evaluations, if you haven't already done them, to answer question number one. Because I found interesting phenomenon. You know, we're just starting this online evaluation. We've been doing it for about a year now, something like that. And a significant number of students missed question number one, which is the only question on that evaluation that actually counts. Now, we used to get that with the paper evaluations too, but it was even higher on the online. So about 10% of my students last term did not answer question number one. So make sure that you answer question number one as well as all the other questions. The other questions give us feedback. Question number one is the question that really counts. So just some thoughts. I don't know if you've already filled out your evaluation, whether you can actually access them again and go back or not. Probably not. But for those of you that haven't done it, just some tips and hints and so forth. Okay? So, that being said, let's see. We've been looking at reproduction. Last time we were looking at female reproduction, right? And two aspects of it. One, the formation of the gametes. And we saw that the meiotic divisions in females are quite different from the aspect of the cytokinesis, the fact that every time the cell divided, we'd get one large cell. Well, the first time, we'd get the one large cell and then one small cell. Well, the second time it divides too. We retain that cytoplasm, right? So we wind up with one large egg, which is roughly the size of the original cell that started the whole process. And then we wind up with these two or three really small cells, the polar bodies, which are there solely as a way to get rid of those extra chromosomes. We've got four copies of each chromosome that we've got to disperse into those four cells. And so the polar bodies provide a place to put those, but we're only going to wind up with that one single mature egg that will be fertilized and can produce the next generation. So, quite different there. And then we looked at the hormonal control and talked about various hormonal interactions that happen over the course of the female reproductive cycle. Remember, roughly a 28-day cycle. And we saw the different things that, again, I've listed up here. And you can always download that from the review website that you can access from Moodle. And if you didn't get all of those things written down in the lecture note packet or something. But be familiar with those, the different hormonal interactions that go on. I compared a little bit male and female gamete production, and I've made maybe a little more definitive list here at the bottom over here when we think about the two. The idea that just from the get-go, just anatomically, there are differences, like the testes are outside the body, the ovaries inside the body. And there, that has to do with temperature requirements and so forth. We saw that in the testes, there are stem cells that will divide and divide and divide, divide mitotically, producing one cell that's going to undergo meiosis and another stem cell. That one divides mitotically, producing another cell that's going to undergo meiosis and yet another stem cell. So the idea of stem cells in the testes and the walls of the seminiferous tubules gives the male the capacity for kind of producing an unlimited number of spermatozoans. Whereas we saw in the female in the ovary, there are no stem cells. Right? At birth, every single cell that has the potential for undergoing meiosis and becoming a mature ovum is already there within its own little follicle of cells that are surrounding it. And it's just over the course of time, then under hormonal direction, some of those will begin to develop, and those that develop fully will produce the mature ova and release those through the ovulation event. So stem cells in males, no stem cells in females, limited number of cells in female, but plenty. Remember, something like a million at the time of female baby is born, something like a million follicles with the primary oocytes, we call it, the cell that's undergoing meiosis for the first division, within there, but then constantly degenerating and degenerating over time. But a woman only producing maybe on average 400 to 500 mature gametes over the course of her lifetime. Number three there, with the male, we saw four small equal-sized gametes, right, the spermatozoa with the female, the one large gamete conserving the cytoplasm so that there's enough material there until that little embryo gets implanted in the uterine wall and starts to draw nourishment through the placenta. And then four, we talked last time about how male reproduction is basically non-cyclic, whereas female is cyclic. You generally produce one, maybe two, mature ova over the course of a reproductive cycle. Three or four would be much more unusual. But in males, it's maybe tracking sperm reproduction over the course of a day. You might see some cycling and so forth, but there's no feedback. There's nothing that shuts off the maturation of sperm and so forth like there is in the female, where estrogen that's being produced by the follicles suppress the development of other follicles. They cause the pituitary to shift in secretions and so forth. So there's a lot of feedback going on in the female. You just don't see that, at least to the point of turning the whole system on and off in the male. And that's why when you think about female reproduction, it's much easier to develop pills that a woman can take that control her reproductive cycle, because it's turning on and off. So there are things that you can do to trick the whole thing and basically turn it off. Whereas males, it's much more difficult to produce some sort of a pill that a man might be able to take that will shut down sperm production and then reliably let it come back on again. You can probably shut it down, but the question is, can you get it started up again once you shut it down? So much more challenging problem there. So we talked about those things, hormonal regulation of the male and so forth. Those are the kinds of things that we dealt with last time. So today, I want to kind of pick up with this. We've created the gametes now. And I want to talk about some things that you looked at in lab last week a little bit more, in a little bit more detail, and look at the developmental process. Well, let's start with fertilization, though. Fertilization of the egg before we can have an egg develop, a zygote develop, right? The fertilized egg, the zygote develop, we've got to get it fertilized. So what's going on in the case of humans? And in the case of starfish or urchins and so forth, when you look at these cool little movies that we have, and I've got some more movies that I'm going to show you in a few minutes, what they'll do is they'll collect the eggs. They'll be shed by the sea urchin, and you can cause the sea urchin to shed the sperm too, and they'll take these all and mix them together in huge quantities and so forth, so you've got all these bazillions of sperm swimming around, all these hundreds of eggs and so forth, and then so in a beaker you can get them to get fertilized, and you can watch the developmental process. In humans, of course, we're not talking about test tube babies now, we're talking about the natural process. In humans, the mature ovum has to be released from the ovary. Sperm have to be deposited in the vagina, and then they're going to find their way up there. You know, and it's estimated that the adult male releases about 100 million sperm per milliliter of semen, and probably about 2.5 mils of semen. So, you know, there may be like 250 million sperm released, all trying to fertilize that one egg. You know, it kind of comes back to that article that you read and turned in the answers for last Friday. It's like, is this ridiculously inefficient or what? To call upon 250 million sperm to fertilize one egg. So the author of that first article, you know, talked about human conception being almost absurdly inefficient, right? But the interesting thing is, as you read in that article, if the sperm count is too low, in fact, 50% of men with a sperm count of 20 to 40 million sperm per milliliter are sterile. So what's going on? How come, say, 30 million sperm can't get the job done, 100 million per mil can? What in the world is going on? I just want to make a couple more comments about that article that you read. Remember, it was up to you to grade your answers. To decide whether your answers were consistent with what I thought they should have been. So don't forget to do that. So they were talking about numbers of sperm, but they were also talking about quality of sperm, right, in that article. It's like, is there a problem with the quality of the sperm that are being produced? And there are some indications that there may be, and a lot of these are related to chemicals in the environment. Chemicals that we are putting into the environment for various reasons that are having unanticipated effects on the normal development of fetuses and on the sex organs and so forth. So they talked a little bit about that. Chemical pollutant, DDT, dioxins, PCBs, things that we'll spend a little bit of time next term at the end talking about and what's going on with those. But there are also a lot of, in a lot of the synthetic plastics, there are molecules that mimic estrogens that are in the environment. And it's thought that those may be creating problems too, because not only are they affecting estrogen levels in women, but they're also affecting estrogen levels in men. Now, you might think, well, estrogen is just a female hormone and testosterone is just a male hormone, but that's not true. We all have both of those hormones. In men, of course, the higher levels are going to be with the testosterone, but the estrogen is still necessary. And in females, it'll be the reverse, higher levels of estrogen, but the testosterone is still necessary for certain things too. So if we've got some things out in the environment that are getting into the body that are beginning to mimic those types of things, then they begin to upset the balance in the body and they can affect reproduction. So they were suggesting that they may be involved in certain cancers in humans, you know, aberrant mating behaviors in animals, genital malformations in animals and so forth. A lot of these things that researchers are seeing and trying to figure out what in the world is going on. Why are these things popping up now? And of course, the great alarm that was sounded in that one article was that they had done this huge meta study. Okay, so they had taken the results from a whole bunch of different studies and put them together and churned them over and over with the computer and discovered, based on their study, that at the rate we're going, that men may become sterile with less than 100 years, right, because of decreasing sperm counts and things like that. So that article was kind of an alarming article when it first came out. But then you had the second article to read, and you always got to look for the counterbalancing points. The second article was challenging the first article, right, especially on that point of, is the human population becoming sterile over time? And they pointed out that of the places they looked at, the large areas they looked at, there was really only one area where numbers seemed to be dropping, and that was New York City. And the rest of the areas, the numbers were kind of holding steady. If you were to pull New York City out of that study, then the alarm would be gone. Well, now, of course, the people that did that study don't want the alarm to be gone, probably, because it gives them publicity. But you've always got to look. You've got to be concerned about things like that. Are there outliers that have, for one reason or another, gotten into the study that are causing the results of that study to get shifted? So they suggested if you remove the New York City data that you see a whole different scenario. And the last question I asked you is there, how can you tell which one is true? And let's see, I had one person that said, gosh, I looked throughout all the articles and stuff and I couldn't find the answer. Well, it's really that question was for you to think, but how could you tell? And of course, what it requires is ongoing studies. You know, track sperm counts over more years and see. So that's a prediction that levels are going down. Are they truly? Well, let's just track them over the next 20, 30, 40 years and see if that's what we really see or not. So I don't know that anybody's doing that, but that would be the logical thing to do to try to decide which of these two situations is really the accurate situation. We have to do things like that. So anyway, that was kind of an aside with that particular assignment that he had. So let's get back to what I was talking about. Why so many, or just needing to get one there? Well, there are lots of reasons why when you think about it. First of all, the vagina tends to be acidic, which deactivates sperm. Okay, so they're being deposited in a hostile environment to begin with. So sperm are going to be deactivated. Sperm have to even get close to the eggs, the sperm have to enter the uterus. And you've all seen in lab now, remember the cervix that closes off the bottom end of the uterus. And there's a real thick mucus material that's in there. Around ovulation, that mucus will thin out a little bit. But the sperm have to get up through there. Okay, so a lot of the sperm that are deposited are never even going to get through the cervix. Now, those that get up into the uterus are going to have to make a decision. Do I go to the right or do I go to the left? Because only one of those oviducts will lead to the ovulated egg. So let's assume that that takes care of half of them that have made it in there already. Okay, and I can't put numbers to this as to what we're seeing, but you can see how the numbers, even though we start off with tremendous numbers, the numbers are plummeting at this point as we go along. And then they have to, the sperm have to make their way up the oviduct. Remember, there's a current towards the uterus that is created by the cilia in the oviduct. So they're fighting against the current to swim up there. They have to get up there. And it's estimated that maybe only 5,000 or 6,000 ever reach the upper levels of the oviducts where fertilization usually occurs. That's still a lot, but it's better than one or two, because once they get there, they've still got to find the egg. Right, so those that do get in the near vicinity of the egg, their acrosomes, remember when we looked at the sperm, there was that little structure on top of the head called the acrosome, and I told you that that explodes out and releases enzymes that will help them to digest their way through some outer coatings of cells and actually be able to penetrate the egg. So those that get near will release their acrosomes will burst, that will start this enzymatic activity going, and then finally one sperm is going to penetrate that egg first. That's the winner. After that, then the fertilization membrane forms rather quickly to prevent more sperm from penetrating. And then the sperm nucleus and the egg nucleus will fuse, and you've got your zygote, and you're off and running. So it's really, you know, it seems like a ludicrous amount of sperm involved, but when you think about how many actually get to the goal, it's really not that many. So we talked about with fertilization, three things are going to happen, right? We're going to start to get mitotic cell divisions. And so they'll divide and divide and divide. You looked at that in lab last week and saw that the 2-cell, the 4-cell, the 8-cell, and on and on and on. You also saw in lab that at some point, when we really got hundreds of thousands of cells probably, the differentiation starts to happen. The cells start to become different, and they start to become destined into what they're going to be. And the first sign of that was that in pocketing on the glastula, remember, was the hollow ball of cells, and then the gastrula would come along and start to in pocket in. And so that's just the beginning of the differentiation process. Differentiation differentiation involves several different things that are going on. So one would be the progressive modification or specialization of particular cells. So cells are starting to get modified, and they're becoming more specific in what they're going to do. Second thing that this whole thing that we call differentiation involves is cell movements. So we see cell movements and rearrangements. So cells don't necessarily stay put. They move in different ways to begin to create structures. And the third thing that we see, which is oftentimes kind of surprising, is what we call programmed cell death. So there are often cells that serve a purpose, have a particular function during the differentiation process, but later on in that, they're programmed to die. And that helps to reshape the structure. For example, if you were to see a human hand early on, the fingers tend to have a lot of webbing between them. But as differentiation, as development goes along, that webbing starts to disappear. So programmed cell death, those cells are dying back so that we can have separate fingers rather than webbed fingers. Same with our toes. So we see that kind of thing going on. So mitotic cell divisions, differentiation, and then the third thing would be the growth of the organism. And we saw that again last week in lab, where I guess you saw the Bipinaria larva in the starfish with that one larval stage, and the starfish will actually go through another larval stage, and finally it'll be a little tiny starfish that will grow into a big starfish. So growth of the organism and maybe going through some different larval stages is involved there. And then finally, we wind up with the baby, which will continue to grow into the adult. The thing about development, when we think about development from a fertilized egg on up, and you think, okay, now I'm an adult. Now development is done, right? We finally got there. Whew, that's good. No, you continue to develop your entire life. You go through different developmental stages. So, you know, there's the baby, there's the toddler, there's the terrible twos in there somewhere, there's the preteen, there's the teenager, there's the young adult, there's the middle adult, whatever you want to call it, there's the old people, and you continue to develop. Things continue to change up until the time you die. So it's not like we finally get there and that's it. It's just from beginning to end, you're constantly seeing things happening. Now, we looked at the slides, and in a minute I've got a different movie I want to show you. We'll look at those early division stages again. But one thing that I wanted to point out is in this differentiation process. So if we watch the cell from a fertilized egg, say, so here's our zygote, and we saw that that's going to start dividing 2 cells, 4 cells, 8 cells, and etc. And finally, at some point, we'll get a morula. Now, I'm really referring to kind of a echinoderm, starfish, urchin kind of developmental process here, because we develop a little differently, and I'll come back to that in a minute. We go to the morula, and then to the blastula. Remember, the morula was the solid ball of cells. The blastula was the hollow ball of cells. It's really fluid-filled. It's not hollow, but it's got the fluid in the middle. And then the gastrula. That's the point at which differentiation begins. Okay, with the gastrula. And as we see that, one of the first things that we see are these cell movements and rearrangements. And that's kind of signals to us that something is going on. So we're going from, here's our hollow ball of cells. The cells all the way around, and that's just, you know, you've got to picture this three-dimensionally, right? It's just not flat, that's like a cross-section. It's just this, like this Death Star of cells kind of thing. And at some point then, these cells start to move in. So very early on, then we maybe see a movement like that. Okay, and then this will continue to move in. And I'm not even going to try to draw the cells around the edge because it just gets too clunky. But remember, so this is really, really early gastrula. This would be later gastrula. Remember, what's that going to form in here? The digestive tract, right? And in starfish and urchins and things like that, down here, this is going to be the anus. And up here, when this pokes through, that's going to be the mouth. And then we'll get a digestive tract, a little stomach, and cute little things that you can see in the Bipinaria larva. Now, if we were to rotate this 90 degrees, okay, so I want to rotate it so that this area right here, I'm now looking at. So we're no longer looking at it from the side and seeing that. We're now looking at that. What we would see is a small opening and it tends to be kind of a raised opening. And that doesn't even look like anything. That is not a bug. That's a raised opening. I'm so sorry I put all those lines there. Anyway, you get this little hole, and that hole is feeding into this cavity. That is the blastopore. Something that you were asked to look for in lab. So this again, now I'm going to reuse my arrow here. This is pointing at the blastopore. Right here, it's that opening. Now, you can see how we're starting to get two layers here. Okay, now we've got an inner layer of cells, and inner layer of cells here, and outer layer of cells here. And in fact, more cells will start to bud off here, and they're not going to be nearly that large. And they're going to form, actually, a third layer of cells in here. So embryos, one of the characteristics of most animal embryos is that they form three layers. And it's from those different layers that get formed that we can track all the different parts of the animal. The skin, the muscle, the hair, the nerves, the gut, everything can be tracked from these three layers. The outer layer, let's start with the inner layer. The inner layer is the endoderm. Think of that endoderm. Derm refers to a tissue of some type, right? And so that's where that terminology comes from. Endo, think of it inside, right? Inside. The outer layer is called the ectoderm. Ecto means outside, so there's a layer that's on the outside. And you know what? I put my arrow. Arrow needs to go all the way into. It doesn't even show up with the dark. It's going all the way into this inner layer here. Okay, so outer layer, inner layer, endoderm, outer layer, ectoderm, and then this middle layer is called the mesoderm. So that's that third layer. So this is outer, inner, and middle. So at this point, things start to get more complicated than they have been previous to this. And I think what I'm going to do now, let me show you some videos, and then we'll come back to these different layers, and I'll tell you a little bit about what those different layers are going to be forming in humans. Okay, so let me shut that off, and let me see. We had a computer meltdown this morning, so I'm hoping we're up and running. Oh, yes. Oh, no. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Okay. This may or may not work well. We'll see. They may be shouting at you. So, the first little video I wanted to show you is sea urchins, and they're shedding their gametes. Okay, you know, we talk about this, collecting the eggs and the sperm and stuff. How are we, you know, what are we doing? What are we collecting here and so forth? So, this is kind of a crazy little video that I found that shows that.
Here's the bad parenting part. Not only do mom and dad never see the kids, They don't even know which sperm and which egg happen to do the happy dance. The sea urchins simply trust the sea to work its magic. Most of what they radiate forth will be consumed by other marine creatures. However, it turns out that setting their kids adrift is a valuable survival mechanism for sea urchins and many other Florida coast species. In this way, the larvae of these various species are able to populate new areas. And genetic material is swapped and circulated and bolstered and diversified. So if the point of parenthood is to get the kids to leave home and find their own way, well, I guess the sea urchin parents are doing okay.
Okay, so they're just like so many marine things, they simply shed their gametes into the water, and it's just random. What's going to mix? Are they going to find each other? Whatever. But you've got males and females living in close association with each other, and when the female sheds her eggs, then that stimulates the male to shed its sperm. So that's what. And they go through these larval stages, and you saw some of the water column there, and you saw how, you heard how most of the little larvae are going to get eaten by other things, but believe me, enough of them get through to keep the population going. We talked about the fertilization membrane rising, and it turns out that calcium ions are the trigger for that. Now, I've talked about calcium ions before in different things, like they're the trigger for muscle contraction, they're the trigger for this and that. They're involved in all sorts of things. And what we've got here that I thought was kind of interesting is an egg, an unfertilized egg, that has been treated with a fluorescent dye that's sensitive to calcium. So when calcium gets released in the egg, it lights up. And so you can kind of track this, and you can see as that egg gets fertilized and as that fertilization membrane lifts off, calcium is actually flooding through the egg. In fact, the calcium ion is going to be a trigger for releasing the fertilization membrane. So let's take a peek at this.
A sea urchin egg during fertilization is visualized here simultaneously by phase contrast microscopy and by fluorescence microscopy. The egg contains a fluorescent dye that becomes brighter in the presence of calcium ions. When a sperm cell fuses with the egg, the fluorescence image shows a wave of calcium ions that sweeps through the cytosol, starting from the initial point of sperm-egg fusion. Following the path of the calcium wave, we see a membrane, called the fertilization envelope, rising from the cell surface. The fertilization envelope protects the fertilized egg from the outside environment and prevents the entry of additional sperm. The rise in cytosolic calcium triggers an elevation of the fertilization envelope through the process of exocytosis. Exocytosis releases hydrolytic enzymes stored in vesicles. Action of the released hydrolases causes a swelling of material surrounding the cell,
that's
which in turn elevates
the
fertilization envelope. Exocytosis can be visualized directly in this system. For this purpose, the plasma membrane is labeled with the fluorescent dye, seen on the right. Each time a vesicle fuses, it leaves a depression in the plasma membrane, which, in the optical section shown, appears as a ring of increased fluorescent staining. On the left, the differential interference contrast microscopy is used to directly view the exocytic vesicles that underlie the plasma membrane. The vesicles are visible here because they are densely packed with protein and consequently have a different refractive index from the surrounding material. Each time a vesicle exocytoses, it disperses its contents and disappears from the image. This effect is best seen when we step back and forth between adjacent frames of the movie.
Okay, so the raising of the fertilization membrane is caused by those proteins getting dumped out into that space. Calcium's triggering it, getting dumped out, and then that fills the space, they expand, and it hardens that membrane. So that creates that fertilization membrane. This next one was just kind of fun. They're kind of doing the same thing. You've got a series of unfertilized eggs across the top. You can see with the light microscope. And then the ones at the bottom are, again, they have a fluorescent dye in them that will glow when calcium is released. So if you kind of watch what's going on, so I kind of got to watch both at the same time what's going on at the top as well as the bottom, you can see the release of the calcium. So real quick release of the calcium, and then if you look closely at those ones at the top, you'll see that they've all got fertilization membranes now that are out and protecting the eggs from further sperm penetration.
But it's not made out of calcium, the membrane.
No, the membrane is a membrane. It's a normal membrane. Calcium is the trigger. Okay, so this is, I was wondering what this was. This is the, so time lapse of the early developmental cleavage of a fertilized sea urchin egg. Okay, so we're gonna see roughly the first 4 hours and watch what goes on here. So you've seen this sort of thing before, but this one's kind of fun, so. Because they turn green all over, and that's always a good sign when the sea urchin egg turns green, you know, where's going on. Okay, and then the last one I wanted to show you, just a real quick little clip of this gastrulation that we've talked about, where we're starting to get development, we're starting to see the cells move in. And let me see, I'm going to try to point out some things to you on this. They may go by really quickly, so we'll see. Okay, so there it's starting. That's the mesoderm right in there, some of those cells. There you can see that in-pocketing happening. The blastopore is right here. It's the endoderm that's forming. This will all become the ectoderm on the outside here. And that was a time lapse. I don't know what the length of time that we were looking at there was, but then that, of course, is going to go on. Combination of cell movements and cell divisions and so forth that are pushing that up and in, and we're going to get the mesoderm starting to divide more and eventually filling this whole thing. So that would... Okay, let's set that aside for the time being. Hello. So, let's see. What mischief can we get into now? Let's talk about the human situation real quick. So we've been, you know, kind of focusing on these sea urchins and starfish because they're real easy to get access to follow and so forth to look at. What's going on in the human? Now, you looked at that. last week in lab also. And remember, the blastula in the human is a little different, because not only do we have the cells lining the outside, but we also have these cells on the inside that are called the inner cell mass. And all of these cells on the outside, remember, are going to contribute to forming the placenta and the umbilical cord and other kinds of structures like that. Whereas the individual is going to form from in here. And we don't form from around embryo, we actually form from a kind of a little plate that forms in the middle here, where cells start to rearrange themselves and so forth. So at the time of implantation, this is what each of you looked like. I'm guessing that you probably don't have any family pictures from there, but that's what you'd have looked like if somebody could have gotten a picture of you. Individual there in the middle. So even though we start off as a little flattened plate of cells, there's going to be an ectoderm, outer layer, endoderm, inner layer, and mesoderm. We're going to form from three tissue layers also. So what in the world are those going to do? Remember, I told you that they're going to form very specific things. So just for some examples, okay, it's not like I want you to try to memorize all these things, but it's good to know just what might be forming here. So ectoderm. Now remember, ectoderm is going to be the outer layer of the three layers. Ectoderm in humans is going to form things like skin. Our hair comes from ectoderm. Our nerves all come from ectoderm. You might say, well, why is that? I mean, that's the outer layer. The nerves are inside and so forth. But remember when you looked at the frog embryos and you saw that neural tube form, the neural plate and the neural tube, and said when that forms, then the spinal column's going to form in there, the brain's going to form at the front. That's all ectoderm tissue that's forming that, that's growing up and around to form that neural tube. So that's where our nerves come from. Things like the lens of the eye, nasal cavities, sinuses, nerve, sense organs, etc. All of those things are going to be coming from that tissue that we can identify as the ectoderm, the outer part of that very, very early embryo. Looking at the middle, that mesoderm, we can track that and we can see that's going to form things like muscle and connective tissues. The epithelial linings of blood vessels. The gonads, the reproductive cell producing organs, and their ducts come from mesoderm, and so on. So all of these things are originating from that middle kind of tissue. And then finally the endoderm, that inner tissue, things like the epithelium of the gut, which kind of makes sense because, you know, in this example here, the gut's being formed. Here's the endoderm, right? And the gut's being formed from that. So the epithelium of the gut and associated structures. The epithelium of the vagina. The urethra. And various glands. All come from the endoderm. So it's not just kind of random, like, well, this cell, I think I'll become this, and that cell, I think I'll become that. It's all, it gets very programmed as to what's going to become what. And we can see that way back to when we start getting those three germ layers forming, those three layers, we can track those. And we can see, oh, this is always going to become this, and this is always going to become that. During the developmental process. So how does that happen? It's thought that development occurs as the result of what we call embryonic induction. So we're actually back above. So their embryonic tissues see their differentiation, blastopore, dorsal lip, embryonic induction is kind of where we're at. I've managed to mix up the order here just a little bit. So coming back to the blastopore again. Okay, let me come back to this drawing. Okay, so there's our young gastrula is poking in, and here's the blastopore again. So that's the blastopore is the opening, right? And this the tissue around is kind of a little bit raised, if you can imagine, raised a little bit, and it's called the lip of the blastopore. And there's a particular region on this lip of the blastopore where the cells become differentiated first. So they're starting down a path to something. We call that determination. When a cell is determined, then it's going to become whatever it's been determined to become. So if it's in an area where it would become the lens of an eye, once it's determined, it's going to become a lens of an eye. If it's in an area where it was going to become a muscle, once it's determined, it's going to form into a muscle. Prior to that, prior to determination, the cells in an embryo can become anything. Okay, but once they're determined, then they're going to become what they're going to become. And it's thought that this whole thing happens at one point along this lip of the blastopore, and it spreads out in all directions so that as one group of cells become determined, then proximity to another group causes the next group to become determined, and proximity to them causes the next group. So this is what we embryonic induction. One area is inducing the next area, which is inducing the next area, which is inducing the next, and that kind of sweeps around the embryo until that entire embryo has become determined. Now, prior to the whole embryo becoming determined, like I said, those cells could be anything, but once that whole embryo is determined, then those cells are going to become what those cells are going to become. And there were some interesting experiments that were done early on, probably 100 years ago now, no, maybe not quite that long, 80 years ago now, where people were looking at this process and asking the questions like, is it really true that there's a time when I can maybe transplant a patch from here, patch of cells from here, and transplant it into here? Is there a time when that will just become another patch of cells over here? Or is there a time when whatever that was going to be would actually form over here? And that's how we came upon this idea of embryonic induction. Because prior to determination, you can take a patch of cells from here, and you can move them over here, you can move them anywhere you want, and they will become whatever that region that you transplant them into becomes. So these are undetermined cells, moving them, they'll become determined for this area. However, if these cells have become determined, let's suppose that these cells are going to form, oh, just for the sake of outrageous example here, let's suppose they're going to form a leg. Okay? And we know that a leg is going to come from these cells. Of course, a leg is a whole lot more complicated, and it's built up of different tissues and stuff, but let's say a leg is going to come from there. Prior to determination, if we transplant it over here where, say, we're going to get an eye, then those cells will become an eye. Once those cells have become determined, if we transplant them over here to where we're going to get an eye, we're going to have a leg hanging out of our eye, because those cells are going to become a leg. They've been set down their path of development. They've been determined. Embryonic induction, one area inducing the next area, inducing the next area to become what it's going to become until the whole embryo has become induced in that manner. This happens at a really young age, as you might imagine, of an embryo. By the time an embryo is 8 to 10 weeks old, all of the tissues of the body have been determined. Okay, so determination is done. They're all determined as to what they'll become. And that's why reproduction, the first trimester in human development is so absolutely critical. Because if you get something into your body that interferes with this determination process, you're going to wind up with an embryo that's formed, a fetus's form, that's defective in one way or another. And we've seen lots of examples of that over history. There are certain chemicals called teratogens. And I think all of a sudden we're over on page 84. Certain chemicals called teratogens that are able to cross what we call the placental barrier. Now, let's think about the placenta for just a minute. Remember, you've seen in lab this week that it's composed of both maternal tissue and fetal tissue. The maternal tissue looks kind of like a sponge, right? And the fetal tissue, the chorionic villi on the outside of the chorion of the fetus, they're little finger-like projections that stick down into the sponge-like openings in the maternal tissue, right? And that together forms the embryo. Those chorionic villi are being bathed by maternal blood, and that's where exchange is happening. The fetal blood is not coming into contact with the maternal. We're not sharing blood, because the fetal blood is within capillaries that are within the tissue of the chorionic villi. So we've got at least two cells separating the fetal blood from the maternal blood. That's how we want it to be. Well, that's where exchange is happening. That's where the barrier is. Things that can cross through those cells on the chorionic villi then can be shared between the mother and the fetus through their blood. So things like carbon dioxide, you know, the fetus outgasses carbon dioxide to the mom has to get rid of it, picks up oxygen from the mom's blood, donates its waste, its nitrogen-containing waste, all those kinds of things that the kidneys would ordinarily do for us, give them to the mom and let the mom's kidneys deal with that. So there are a lot of different things that can cross that so-called placental barrier, including various kinds of drugs and other chemicals that we might find. And teratogens are those things that can cross the barrier that will cause defects in the embryo. It's going to interfere somehow with the development of that young embryo. Especially critical in that first trimester, because that's when determination is happening. Right? And interestingly enough, oftentimes a woman doesn't even know for sure necessarily if she's pregnant in that first trimester. That's the most, probably the most critical time. So let me give you an example of a teratogen. There's a drug called thalidomide. Thalidomide, which was developed back in the early 60s, and it was marketed as a tranquilizer of sorts to help women with morning sickness. And apparently it worked fairly well. So some women get tremendous morning sickness, you know, just really upset stomach and so forth in the morning. And this was seen, especially in England, I think it was developed in England, so that's where it had its first introduction. So lots of women were on thalidomide. And it was discovered that all of a sudden, we were getting the births of all of these babies that had defective arms and legs. And what thalidomide will do, it will cross the placental barrier and interfere with the development of what we call the limb buds when they're developing at a very, very young age. And so these people were being born with arms that were really, I can only describe them as flippers, because they basically had no arm. They'd have a little hand-like structure, probably not complete with fingers, on each side perhaps, but no arms. And the same with legs. So when all of a sudden all these babies were being born like this, they were able to track it back to the thalidomide. Something that was developed to really aid women and then, you know, had a tremendous consequence on their offspring. So that's an example of a teratogen. Yeah. Teratogens are really crazy things. You hear about a woman doesn't want to get the German measles if she's pregnant between 8 and 12 weeks or something like that, because the measles virus produces a toxin that can cross the placental barrier, can get into the embryo, and can interfere with normal development again, normal determination. So that's another example of a teratogen. Heavy alcohol consumption during pregnancy affects the proper development of the fetus. So you could argue that alcohol, at least heavy use of alcohol, acts like a teratogen also, crossing the placental barrier and really having some dramatic effects on the children. If you've heard of fetal alcohol syndrome, which is what oftentimes these children have if their mom has consumed a lot of alcohol during pregnancy. They have physical and mental aberrations that are pretty characteristic, and they really have problems throughout life. So teratogens are things that interfere with this whole process, and obviously things to avoid if one is pregnant, especially in the early pregnancy. Let me stop talking here for a few minutes. Let's take a break, and we come back. Okay. Let's finish this up, shall we? Good idea. Ladies. Would you tell her to be quiet? Okay. So, talking about the developmental process and so forth, and how it happens, how we kind of understand it to happen now. It's interesting to kind of track the history of this. You know, as people have, of course, wanted to know what's going on, how does it happen? And the oldest view was a view called epigenesis. People thought they really had this nailed. Epigenesis, over here on the last page of the lecture notes. Epigenesis was the idea that form took shape out of basically out of unstructured matter. Okay, so you look at the egg and you look at the sperm, they fuse together, you wind up with a zygote, but that's just unstructured matter. And so somehow out of this unstructured matter came the child, came the adult, and so forth. So that was an understanding. And you can see where people might think that, you know, by looking at it and by just trying to figure that out. Now, as microscopes got better, especially the development of the compound microscope and so forth, people could look at much smaller things and study them in detail. And microscopists all of a sudden discovered, they made an absolutely startling discovery. They discovered that if you look at a sperm, look at the head of the sperm, what did they find in there? They found a little person that was already ready to go. Okay, and so what needed to happen was that sperm needed to fuse with the egg in order to get the nourishment so that it could go ahead and develop. And they called that a homonucleus, right? And they called this idea preformation. So, all ready to go in the sperm are these little guys, and they just need the proper environment, the proper nourishment, and so forth. Now, there are, you might think, that's kind of a crazy idea, and you know, I just don't even know how they saw that in there, but there are situations where that's the case. Have you ever wondered, occasionally you might go out in the morning after it's rained, and all of a sudden in your lawn there are all these mushrooms. You ever wondered where the mushrooms come from? How can they do that? They weren't there yesterday, they're there today. What's going on? Well, it turns out that in mushrooms, they really are preformed. They've got these little primordia that are down underground, and they're just waiting for water. And when the water comes, they'll absorb that water osmotically, they'll expand tremendously, and so you walk out the next morning, and there's that mushroom where there hadn't been one before, and they can be quite large, too. So the idea of preformation isn't so far out, at least in certain situations, where things are all ready to go, and it's just a matter of adding something, like in the case of the mushroom. But I can reassure you all right now that is not the case in human reproduction. Okay, there aren't little people inside the sperm heads. So what's the modern view? The modern view is actually a combination of both. Okay, so when you look at the fertilized egg, you say, okay, that is, in a sense, unstructured matter. You've got the organelles, you've got the nutrients and so forth, but comparing that to, say, the adult, there's really not a whole lot of structure in there. So yeah, okay, so there's an element of epigenesis, but we know that it's just not a random process, right? The instructions for creating that next individual are in the nucleus. They're in the DNA of the nucleus. So from that standpoint, we could say, well, the information is already preformed. The plan is there, right? It just has to be worked out with the developmental process. So we're kind of a combination of both here, where we have the preformed plan, we've got the unstructured matter that under the right conditions, with the right signal, with fertilization triggering the development, that then we're going to go through a developmental process to form the next generation. During the process, we know that all the information is there, and all the information is there in every cell. All right, so in every cell of your body, except for the sex cells, every cell of your body, except for cells that don't have a nucleus, and the red blood cells are one of the main ones of those, the megakaryocytes, blebbing off the clotting factors and things will be another example. But most cells, every cell carries the complete set of information. But every cell doesn't use the complete set of information. So as we understand the developmental process now, it's a process of turning genes on and off. Now you're going to have a certain set of genes in that DNA that are always going to be turned on. You need them. They're for metabolism, for this and that, various things that your cell has to do to maintain itself, to make membranes, to do all that. So those would be kind of generalized functions that have to happen in the cell. But then there are the real specific functions that happen within a cell. So for example, in a rod cell of an eye, the rods give us our color vision, right? Very, very specialized. They have a lot of structure to them. There'd be a certain suite of genes that have been turned on in that cell that produce proteins that wind up with that rod cell, wind up creating that rod cell, creating a cell that's sensitive to light, that when light of a certain wavelength hits it, it will depolarize and send information off to the next cell. So a certain suite of genes, specialized genes, are going to be turned on in that cell that aren't turned on in any other cell in the body unless you're another rod cell. Okay? And in your tongue, one of the nerves in the taste bud, you're going to have a certain suite of genes that are turned on that give the taste bud the shape and the ability to be sensitive to chemicals in your food that are going to allow them, that nerve cell, then to form and communicate with your brain. And the only place those are going to be turned on is in those taste bud cells. You're not going to have them turned on in your rod cells, in your eye. There's no need for that. We need other specialized things. So if you can see what I'm getting at, we have a differentiation process involves the turning on and turning off, sequential turning on and turning off, of a variety of different genes that are carried in the genome. Probably the majority of those genes are turned off. We've got a bunch of specialized ones that are turned on in those particular cells to give us specialized cells. So the cells lining the stomach that are producing hydrochloric acid are going to have different genes turned on in them than, say, the cells at your fingertip that give you the sense of touch. So that developmental process is that sequence of turning things on and off. So the process of embryonic induction, we come back to that, is that process whereby genes are turned on and off. So proximity, it's still not clear how embryonic induction happens. It's not clear how in cells certain genes are turned on and certain genes are turned off. People have looked at a lot of different things. Is it just physical contact? When one cell is becoming one thing, just physical contact with that cell that causes another cell to become something different, but something predictably different? Is it some sort of a chemical being shared between the cells from the cell that's developing that then induces the next cell to it? Is it maybe some little virus-like particles? You know, there are a lot of ideas that people have as to what might be going on with that process, but it's not clear exactly how that works. And you think of those different kind of ideas, and you think in terms of teratogens and how teratogens can interfere with this, and it kind of gives you some guidance, maybe a little bit, as to what the nature of that embryonic induction might be. But we don't have, to my knowledge, we don't have any great answers yet for that. And that brings up some interesting issues, like cloning. You know, a little while ago, wasn't that long ago, when the mules that were cloned in Utah were all the big news. Mules are sterile. All right, mules are formed as a combination between a horse and a donkey, and they're sterile. They don't produce gonads that produce gametes. They have an incompatibility with chromosomes. They can't do meiosis. And I never realized this until this whole deal erupted with the cloning of the mules, but there are people that race mules. Racing mules is a big deal. Okay, you know, racing mules is a big deal among some people. But, you know, like with racehorses, what do? You got a champion racehorse, you put them out to breed, right? And you hope that they'll produce more champions. Maybe yes, maybe no. You can't do that with mules. So if you got a champion mule, wouldn't it be nice if you could clone that mule to get another and another? So that's what they were looking at doing and so forth, and they were successful in cloning. You may remember Dolly the lamb, the first mammal that was cloned. Dolly met kind of an unkind demise. It turned out that she did not live the happy, normal life expectancy of a sheep normally. There were some issues in the cloning and so forth. I don't really know what happened with the mules that were cloned in Utah either. I can reassure you, though, that there are not 50 Hitlers running around South America because he got cloned before he died. There are people who would suggest that. Cloning, the idea behind cloning is that you take an undifferentiated, a relatively undifferentiated cell. So probably one of the best cells to use would be like a skin cell, not the dead cells, one of the live skin cells, which is fairly undifferentiated, and reset the clock, restart the clock. And how can you restart that clock so that that developmental process starts over again? That's the idea. That would be the idea behind cloning. And people have tried various means of doing that. Generally, what's been used in like frogs and other things would be to take an egg from the species, remove the nucleus, and then take the nucleus from a skin cell, say, and pop that nucleus into the egg, and do something to trigger fertilization and to mimic fertilization, and then let that organism go ahead and get a new organism from that. You might say, now wait a minute, we're dealing with a haploid, we're dealing with a diploid nucleus from the skin cell, so we're okay. So don't even try that one on me, because it didn't work with me. So you got a diploid nucleus in the first place, and you're letting it reproduce, okay. That's fraught with problems. One thing that we've learned is that chromosomes have these little ends on them called telomeres. And every time a cell divides, the telomeres get a little bit shorter. And so one of the things that has been observed for a long time is that cells tend to have a certain number of times that they can divide, and then they're not going to divide again. And that has to do probably with this telomere length. So if you're going to clone something, somehow not only do you have to restart the clock, but you have to restart it in such a way that the telomeres are regrown so that everything is ready to go. Anyway, that's the idea behind cloning. How can we make more of the same, right? And wouldn't it be fun to clone a pet dog? Well, there are people who will do that, right? And there are companies that will do that now. What people don't realize probably is that when you start off with your clone, you're going to wind up with a young, you know, you go through all the baby stage, all that kind of stuff, and eventually you get the adult, and there's no guarantee that clone is going to behave the same way that the adult that it came from behaved. Because of an area that we're just learning about called epigenetics, we're finding out that turning on and off the DNA is a whole lot more complicated than we thought it was. Anyway, cloning. That would be, you know, can we clone things? And we can be successful in cloning a lot of things. Humans are not being cloned right now. Regeneration is another issue. You know, there are like salamanders. If the salamander loses a leg, it will grow a new leg. Well, why can't we do that? You know, if someone loses an arm, why don't we grow a new arm? So there are people working on in those areas too, as to how do you stimulate regeneration? How do we, in essence, kind of reset the clock, the developmental clock, in parts of the body so that we can regrow new things? Now, what's mostly being done now is trying to grow things outside. Like if you go into YouTube, probably you can find a video on growing an ear on a mouse and little things like that, you know, so that you can replace an ear. But that's not the same thing as growing that new ear back. And so there's a whole area of research in this area of regeneration and kind of restarting the clock too. And a lot of this is using what are called stem cells. Okay, but there are different kinds of stem cells. These are what they call pluripotent stem cells, if you've heard that term. This embryo, before it's determined, is composed of pluripotent stem cells. Presumably they can become anything. But then once it gets determined, they're no longer able to do that. So there's a lot of research going on now, especially with adult stem cells. They're finding adult stem cells everywhere in the body. to make them into pluripotent stem cells so you can inject them into areas and maybe they'll reform things that have been lost. And there's been a certain amount of success with that. So anyway, you know what? Let me stop there. Don't forget, we've got question and answers on Tuesday and Wednesday and the final on Thursday. So I'll see you all then, and I hope you have a good time up to then. Study it. Take it other things. So that by the end of next term, okay, so long.